and Gunashtish for being here with us today on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The name of the canoe is Yadachun. In Thlinkit, that word means straight ahead or going forward. For Robert Mills, it has been a journey to design this traditional canoe and to have it fashioned out of aluminum. And he's here with us now to talk about that. And we are so excited. It's soon going to be installed on the waterfront. And so I just have to ask you, Robert, do you just feel on pins and needles, almost like you were waiting for your baby in the delivery room to come?
I don't think I would take it that far. There's definitely some excitement because, you know, this has almost been a year in the making. Just shy of, shy of a year. So, you know, it's definitely been a journey. And now that we're on the fringe of it, I'm excited to share it and help it find its home.
Well, as a matter of fact, speaking of babies, your son, we can hear him in the backdrop. So you've kind of had two processes going on at the same time, fatherhood and then this big artistic venture.
Yeah, definitely a lot happening, a lot to juggle, a lot of moving parts. And I'm learning as I grow that I have little to no control over those moving parts. And slowly learning to just enjoy the process of it all.
I can hear him. So we'll enjoy having him on our show as well. What's your son's name?
His name is Kunisi.
Kunisi. And when was he born?
He was born in February of this year.
Wow. So how far did the canoe project precede him?
We finished just before he was born, fortunately.
So this canoe is going to be something that we will all appreciate, like the whale sculpture that's already out there. It's one more thing to see on the Overstreet Park walkway, seawalk there. How do you feel about it going in that particular spot?
I've grown to love it, actually, having spent enough time out there walking. You know, it wasn't my initial pick, but I've grown to love it. And as I've found out what Juno Parks and Rec is planning to do with the area, it's kind of perfect. And it's kind of nice that it sits beside the whale as well. So
for people who haven't seen it, we sort of got our first real glimpse of it as the backdrop for the Indigenous Music Festival, Rock Auk. It was broadcast all over the world for people to see. And people just thought it was amazing watching it. You know, and I wondered at that moment when it was displayed there if that was going to be its mission to move around to different places. But it seems like it's going to be permanently anchored in this spot.
Yeah, I think it's kind of symbolic of where we are at in this particular point, in that, you know, to galvanize us as Indigenous peoples, we now have to use Western constructs. So I think it's symbolic that with this canoe sculpture, we are using aluminum to kind of plant us here forever. That thing will be here for, you know, long, long after I'm gone.
Well, when we read our land acknowledgments on KTOO, you know, we always talk about the waterfront and how once there were canoes and people traveling from villages going out to hunt and fish. It seems like that canoe should be there to remind us that the parking lots and all the things that have gone up since then were really not part of the original landscape. What do you see when you're walking out on that seawalk?
I think that you know, this CBJ has done a good job as trying to make that specific area as natural or organic as possible in this waterfront that's, you know, that's saturated with non-organic places. It's kind of nice to walk out there. And to me, the makeup is, you know, it's a vignette of home, beaches of home. So I think it's pretty fitting.
So this project is going to have several phases, and I understand that the installment is the first phase. So has the weather caused some challenges? Because I know they had hoped to have it installed by yesterday, but apparently the weather has slowed that down.
Yeah, it has. My dad used to say sometimes you just have to let the tide come in. What can you do? And hopefully the weather will cooperate. As far as I know, they're moving forward with it. So hopefully early next week it will be put in place.
So tell us a little bit about the dimensions of this and how much it weighs for those of us who may not have seen a picture of it or seen it at the Rock Ock Festival.
It's 20 feet, 10 inches long from point to point. And then the highest point, which is the bow, is 91 inches high. I believe the lowest point of the gunwale is 41 inches. And then the width of the bottom of the paddles, which would be the widest point, is approximately six feet. And it probably weighs 250 pounds or so.
And so where did this idea germinate for this? I know that you had apparently gotten a grant that was for COVID relief, and so it turned into sort of this labor of love, but the COVID relief money made a project like this possible. So had the idea come before the grant money came, or did you just sort of, once you got the grant, you started thinking about it?
I'm always thinking. You know, I'm always dreaming. I operate best when my head's in the clouds, I always say. So it's been one of those things that have kind of been drifting about, and on this crazy art journey, I've learned never to put limitations on anything. And if I really believe in something and take action, then, you know, I believe those ideas come to fruition. My career is testament to that thus far. So it's been ruminating around, and then, opportunity came, and due to the time constraints, the deadline that they wanted the piece done, you know, to make something in wood monumental scale just was not possible. So it just kind of worked out that this canoe sculpture came to be.
Well, it certainly is beautiful. And it's kind of interesting in that it's sort of the skeleton of the canoe, the outline of the canoe, and your imagination has to fill in the rest. Is that what you were going for?
Oh yeah, definitely. So the gunwales, you know, there are characteristics of a Northwest Coast canoe that are just aesthetically beautiful. And so, you know, it was a process that I had to find out which aesthetics I was going to embellish a little bit and enhance without losing the essence. And as far as the negative void that is in place where the body of the canoe would be, that void kind of symbolizes the the political and social unrest that we've been treading through, you know, during this past, since before COVID, I guess. So definitely enhanced by COVID. So it kind of is, the negative space is symbolic of that period of time here in the United States.
Well, as they say, sometimes less is more. You know, that very beautiful minimalistic design in that. So you had to translate this idea into an aluminum structure. So you actually had to get some help fabricating that. What happens with that? What's that process all about?
It can be an incredibly delicate process to collaborate with somebody. You're dealing with some like intimate creative spaces with individuals and to try to navigate that without ego, just these some of these characteristics of humanity can be tricky. And fortunately, I was able to find somebody that absolutely fit that. And, it's almost like we were destined to cross paths with one another. And, Brian Crapo, the fabricator, I'm happy to say that I didn't just find somebody to collaborate with, but at the end, I found a friend as well. So,
well, that makes it even better. So when this gets installed and it's happening in phases, can we walk out to it? Will there be a path to it? Will it be lit? How will we see it presented?
Yeah, so it'll be parallel to the existing path that exists. It'll be on the beach side of the walkway. I believe they're planning on removing the fencing. So you'll be able to walk to it and access it. And it'll be illuminated. I was quite adamant about making sure it's going to be lit as, we're entering some pretty dark months ahead. So I think it's an opportune time to bring some illumination to the piece, but as well as to our lives as well.
There are so many deep thoughts behind this, illuminating our lives, the navigation aspect of a canoe. Why did you choose the name Yadachun, which I guess translates into going forward? What were you hoping to tell people?
There are many nuances to the canoe. One that I'll add is, it's accessible to walk around because I wanted it, the height of it is thought out to where if people are on the opposite side of the canoe, and those people are going to be of all different races, ages, sexes, and from the opposing side, it's going to look as if that person is in the canoe as well. And vice versa. But as far as the name goes, Yadachun means straight ahead, and it's kind of poking fun at humanity because we never go straight ahead. We're always vacillating in one direction or the other, especially during this divisive time. So it's kind of kind of humorous, but also, I think if we zoom out and take a greater scope of things, we realize that the left, you know, going to the left or right, ultimately we are moving straight ahead. So, you know, I think it's kind of humorous, but as well as a greater context of time, you know, the hope is we're all in this together and we're trying to move ahead.
Well, those are great sentiments, you know, to know that all of those things are wrapped up into this project, which is still on a journey. I guess the fundraising continues for this. I see that the Juno Arts and Humanities Council has a GoFundMe page for this. How much more needs to be raised to complete this project?
I can't say for certainty a number. I don't really deal with the specifics of numbers necessarily. You know, it's like anything else. It's how many bells and whistles do we want to add to it? Obviously, if you want more, it's going to cost more. I just believe that once we get it in place and people see it, you know, you've seen it from afar and really appreciate it. And I think once you get to see it in person and it's there, and it's there, it's in this air quotes natural environment, you know, I think it's going to, people are going to say absolutely and push it even further. So,
well, we've heard your little baby in the background there. Do you look forward to taking him when he's old enough to walk to see your canoe, and how do you envision him interacting with it and other children?
Well, that's a great question. I did kind of design it to where, you know, so much of the way we operate in this world is through the lens of our phones. And so there are definitely spaces that exist in that canoe sculpture where it's interactive in that way. But also, you know, I can only hope that we, as Indigenous peoples, as Indigenous artists, you know, where we are constantly growing. We're not this group of people from the past. We're not encased in this glass lens. We are operating in this world and using Western constructs, Western ideas, you know, because we're all immersed in this world now, and we're using it to bring dialogue to certain issues, certain ideas, certain thoughts. And I can only hope that, you know, as a young person, much like I seen Tlingit art pieces growing up, I was just inspired by masters of the past and seeing something and just saying, wow, I want to do that. And if I can only do that for the younger generation, then I've done my job.
Well, you certainly have. And thank you for giving us something to look about, appreciate. You know, it seems like it's a perfect bookend to the whale out there. So I can't wait to see it, especially at night when it's all lit up. I'm sure that it's going to touch many hearts and inspire many people. So thank you very much, Robert Mills. And also thank your son for his patience in letting you have some of our time today. Gunesh Cheesh.
Gunesh Cheesh. Thank you very much.
up high.
The last issue of Tidal Echoes has been fun to thumb through. Poems by people that I read even before I met them. And when I did, somehow, it just made it extra special. And here is a chance to be a part of Tidal Echoes. And Shailene Moeller, who is the fall junior editor for Tidal Echoes, joins us today. This is a publication of the University of Alaska Southeast. So I want to thank you very much, Shailene. It's so great to have you here with us today. How did you first get involved?
I first got involved with Tidal Echoes back in 2018 when I submitted to Tidal Echoes for the first time. Back then, I submitted a poem that I had written in one of Emily Wall's classes, who is the Tidal Echoes mentor. And it actually got in the journal and won the Mac Barron's Prize. Just super exciting, and I've been submitting to Tidal Echoes since.
Now, that is a wonderful thing, is that through this journal, you can get to know people from all over Southeast Alaska. I mean, there are just poems, essays, photographs. And, of course, in this last issue of Tidal Echoes, there was a lot of poems about COVID. So what do you feel when you browse through Tidal Echoes? Do you feel like it's kind of like a time capsule in some ways?
It does feel that way, yes. And the 2021 edition definitely felt like a time capsule of everything everybody was experiencing during the pandemic, especially since the majority of the poems in there, including one of my own, was centered around that.
So I'd like to ask you to share some of the poems from the last issue. But before we do that, can you talk a little bit about how this magazine works, this journal works? How often does it come out? And what are the timelines for getting submissions in?
So every year, Tidal Echoes is published annually. And every year, the deadline for submissions is December 1st. After all the submissions are received, we go through the editing and the cutting and putting things together, and it is published in the first week of April every year.
How wonderful, so that every year you can have something to look forward, something new on your coffee table. Well, since we were just talking with Robert Mills about his canoe that's going to be appearing on the waterfront soon, weather permitting. I wondered, we had talked about this before, about perhaps culling from Tidal Echoes a poem that sort of captures the spirit of that project.
Yes. And the poem that I brought with me is one called Overlooking by Vivian Faith Prescott. Okay.
Please go ahead.
And it goes like, I want to live on like you, rock sheltered and etched as a porpoise, or killer whale with my a day's work catching rain and sunlight lichen patched. Beside a record of time, dots on a leaning rock wall, noting days and nights in an old winter village. I want to animate shadows and waves like you, beneath overhanging rocks and a canvas, or an image of a face or a paddling canoe. I want to be ground stone and obsidian flakes, red pigment, finding with pitch a vantage point in these uncertain seasons. Oh, to be painted. That's one of my favorites.
Boy, Vivian Prescott has a way of nailing things with a poem, doesn't she? Gives you a very specific image that you can hold. That's what I love.
Yes.
I love about this. In fact, I've got a volume right here in my hot little hands from last year, and I think about some of my favorites, like 10 Sounds That Make You Feel More Alive by Hank Lentfer, and he was the featured author. And among the sounds that make you feel alive, the floating trumpet, the wave of whispers, the afternoon snack, the frozen burp. I don't know. When you've got about 10 minutes, with a cup of coffee to take a break, this book is my favorite companion. So I'm looking forward to the next one. But you've got some things to share with us, and I understand that you have one of your poems that you're going to share with us.
I do. And it was a poem that I had written during the pandemic. It's called Preserving Self, Quarantine Thoughts. Okay. You want me to read it now?
Yes, please go ahead.
Awesome. Here it goes. Like a daisy in resin, I sit frozen in time and place. Once delicate, I've hardened and now glisten. I used to grow, consume, and create. Now I'm preserved for all those to marvel at. Cold, but not artificial, at least not in the same way an image or plastic okay would be. Like a daisy in resin, I'm surrounded by things that have become too familiar. I sit sharing myself through words and images on screen. Craving connection once more, connection to the bustling world as much as connections to people. The chime of an email, the taste of microwave popcorn, the slick, cold feeling of my office floor linger in the tingling sensations in my feet and the echoes in my ears. Like a daisy in resin, I can be worn on a chain, sometimes hidden within the neck of a sweater, letting myself be a secret of my own, other times draped upon a bare chest in an exposed existence or atop a dress against a dark black fabric so I could stand out like a lone star to wish upon. Like a daisy in resin, I wait for myself to be worn proudly by my own being. And in its resin, the daisy remains forevermore to be untouched from the day it was enclosed, undisturbed by hands or beautifying tools, but not me. Like a daisy in resin, sometimes I wonder if I were preserved another way, like jam for consumption, sticky sweet or temporary, or pressed between the pages of my mother's college Bible, browning as it ages, taped to memory, fragile as it decays. Would I serve a different person? Would I serve a different purpose in my stagnant state?
So that was a poem born of COVID. What was going through your mind when you wrote that? What
when I wrote
that?
This, I was frustrated with like not being able to go out and do things I used to be able to. And oftentimes that feeling would make me feel lonely. And like, I didn't have as much opportunities as I used to because of COVID. So that's what most of those verses are about, is just that feeling of frustration.
Well, a poem is a good place to, a safe place to put those frustrations out, and others, of course, could probably relate to it. So before we go, you have one other poem, and this is from the featured writer for this upcoming issue. Can you share that with us?
Yes. Yes. So our featured writer for this upcoming issue is Kirsten Christensen. She has been published in Tidal Echoes numerous times in the past. And one of my favorites from the last edition was Heart as a Burning State. And this one goes, I hail from the crimson heart, tissue-papered organ, one time sinew, other sponge, tied to a stout butcher's knot, one knot ended, the other anchored. Heart scatters memories. In sepia, snapping campfire twinkled eye. Morning lantern's light filtered through mesh of branches, screen of tent, trailed feathered cyrus. Heart is mapped by huckleberries. Stifling the verdant branch, raspberries dotting my palm like Google Map markers. Red teardrop, they travel measured like a bead. From tongue to belly, those from heart dwell in tiny homes with open shuttered windows, unlocking doors. Led to light in airy chambers on a windowsill, perches a stellar jay. Blue jar cobalt, indigo plumed cry, its morning squawk. Bellows to friends, would-be lovers, for peanuts, it will sing a song for gooseberries' flight. Soon I'll pull tent stakes, dry and flag fold shelter, shed this heart, cultivate another.
Wow, so much talent in this region. And it's so wonderful that this journal can bring that forward. You know, I just came across one, Mary Lou Sparks. She turned 90 last year, but it's called Handiwork, and I just love her clean way of expressing herself. I'll read a few lines because I love this. God wears extra tufts as she walks the wetland to check on the Canada geese resting after their long flight. Her blue jeans are damp from the light rain, but it doesn't bother her. You know, I mean, to me, it's amazing that this journal encompasses people who are writers that are 90 years old and young students from UAS. It must be a privilege to be an editor of this magazine.
Oh, it is. And it's honestly like one of the coolest things I've ever gotten to do. Like getting to write articles to represent Title Echoes, advertising for submissions, getting to do things like this interview. It's been really exciting.
Well, it's been wonderful to have here. And before we go, I guess we should also mention that you are the first Indigenous editor for this magazine.
Yes, yes. One thing I must say is like Title Echoes has been awesome for having represented so many Native artists and authors before. And so it was a bit surprising to me to find out that I was the first, I am the first Indigenous editor, but it's also very exciting to me to be able to be representative of that.
And of course, you know, we know from poets like Ishmael Hope that are out there, a Thlinkit poet, that there's much more to be mined, I'm sure, and that you being an Indigenous person will probably have a way to find that, seek that out.
Yes, and I'm definitely looking forward to that. I'll be working with last year's junior editor, who is now the senior editor, Emily Bowman, and we'll be working together to compose a journal that honors people of all walks of life in Southeast Alaska.
And that is what makes Title Echo so special. So before we go, any quick things that you want to remind us about?
Yes. So the submission deadline for Title Echoes is December 1st, and it'll be coming out less than 2 weeks from now. So anybody who's interested in submitting, please submit. We accept submissions for prose, poetry, photography, and all kinds of art forms. And we'd be happy to see your submissions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Shailene Moeller, who is the fall and junior editor of Title Echoes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Afternoon programming is made possible by Royal Caribbean Group, the parent company of Celebrity Cruises, Royal Caribbean International, and Silver Sea. Together with Alaskan cruise destinations, forging long-term partnerships to support community needs. More at RoyalCaribbeanGroup.com.
Filling pantries and filling needs. How you can help the Southeast Alaska Food Bank with their annual food drive. And we have Chris Schopp with us today to talk to us about how we can make sure that lots of people have what they need, especially to get through the holiday season. So thank you so much for being with us. I understand that this food drive is already underway. So how does this food drive work, and how can we help you out to be sure that you get what you need to help others?
So this is actually the 25th annual Caring is Sharing food drive. It's been going on for 25 years. Unfortunately, last year was more of a virtual event with everything COVID-wise that was going on. So this year we're actually back at the store. We're going to be there from 8 to 6 at both Foodland and Super Bear IGA locations tomorrow, asking for donations to help restock the shelves out at the food bank. Primarily we're looking for non-perishables. And if you can't make it out tomorrow and you want to stop by the stores over the weekend at another time and bring us some stuff, you know, you can always do that too. We're here from 8 to 1 Monday through Friday. And then we do have a drop box out front where you can put non-perishables as well. Or if you have a whole bunch of stuff, you can just give us a call, 789-6184, and we'll arrange to try and come pick it up for you.
So how have things been going? I mean, you're in a good place to observe the trends in the community, to see what the needs are by the amount of traffic or requests that you get. So what's the status of people that tend to live on the edges right now?
So for us, one of the major measuring sticks that we go by is we do 2 food pantries every week out here at the food bank, one on Tuesday afternoon and one on Thursday evening. And before COVID, we were seeing between 60 and 90 people per week. And now, you know, the last year or so, we've averaged between 150 and 190 people that we're serving just with the 2 pantries every week. So we know the need is a lot greater than it used to be. And to try to fill that gap for the people out there that are, feeling food insecure, we need more donations, and things are flying off the shelves pretty much as fast as they come in.
So how do people use this food? I mean, do they have kitchens that they can cook? I mean, are you trying to prepare for different scenarios that people have?
Well, in terms of just the pantries, we put out, a number of different food groups, items that we get as donations. You know, we always have a protein. We have veggies, fruit, canned goods, soups, water, different things like that. So we put out items that if you don't have the means to cook in a full kitchen, say you've only got a hot plate, say you've only got a crock pot or you're cooking over a campfire, usually there's things that you can still find to eat. And that's just with the pantries. Now, we also serve 40 different organizations that are members of ours. Not all of them here in Juneau. We do have some in Hoonah, Gustavus, and Pelican as well. So, representatives from those organizations come out through the week and they get items for their clients or for their pantries. And, they're getting as much as they ever did, if not more, as, during the pandemic as well.
Well, before we go, can you recap what we need to know and so that we can be intentional about it and make sure that we get this to you?
So I think, a couple of things to stress is, last year we distributed over 537,000 pounds of food to people who came out for the pantries and to our member organizations. So with the food drive, this is our largest food drive that we do every year. Thanks so much to the IGA stores for, partnering with us. We will be out at both stores from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. tomorrow, and we'll have representatives and volunteers out there collecting food donations. But if you can't make it out to the stores, you can go to our website. It's just seafb.org, and you can donate from the website. You can also find out more information about exactly the items that we need on a regular basis. And you can also email us from the website, drop us a note. You can find our phone number, our mailing address. It's all on there as well.
Boy, over 500,000 pounds of food. That's pretty impressive.
And this is the third year in a row that we've distributed over 500,000 pounds.
My goodness. Well, I hope that you get as much or more, because I imagine that you could always use more, right?
Absolutely. The need, the demand doesn't seem to slow down. I mean, our mission is to try to, help everyone we can, try to beat food insecurity. But, with COVID and people out of work and reduced jobs, it's hard. So a lot of people out there need help. And, we'd rather see somebody pay for their heat and, you know, their electricity right now than have to make that choice with food. So we're here if they need a helping hand.
Well, I thank you very much, Chris Schopp with the Southeast Alaska Food Bank. And I hope that the next time you're on the show, you'll tell us, oh, we gave out 600,000 pounds of food. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Bye. So we are going to get a preview of a theater in the rough play that opens tonight, The Inspector Calls, and a Victorian era period drama that has relevance today. And joining us now to tell us about why they chose this play. And I have to give you a forewarning. It sounds like it's going to be a pretty intense play. Katie Jensen, the director, and Aaron Elmore, who plays the inspector. So welcome. And maybe we should begin with you, Katie, just to tell us a little bit about what the storyline is on this, because it is kind of a dark play.
It is. It has some humor in it, but it is one of Priestley's, J.B. Priestley, one of what he's called his time plays. And it's where he plays with time. It's about this family, this very wealthy family, and how they have had unknowingly interactions with this one young woman, and the interactions that they have had with her lead her toward an ultimate unfortunate choice. But that's the only choice that she feels that she can make. And he wrote it in 1946, and although the play is set in 1912 in an Edwardian period, which is a time, 1912 was right before, and he very specifically sets it about a couple of days before the Titanic sinks. So it's this time where everyone thinks that the world is just going to be fantastic and nothing could possibly go wrong. And, you know, knowing it's 1912, a whole bunch of things are going to come down the line. So it's, for us, it was very, very timely in that we kind of, in the 90s, and the aughts, we were in this period where things are going to get better and nothing's wrong. We're going to keep, you know, things are going to keep getting better and better. And then the world changed. And it's for Priestley, it was very important to him that what we do in all of our interactions have effects not only on other people but on the world. It's a ripple effect. And it, yeah.
Well, I guess I won't beat around the bush because I read a little bit about the play, but the inspector calls on this family because a young woman has committed suicide. And
yes,
he is investigating the reasons behind that and talks to the family. So, Aaron, you get to play the inspector. What kind of a character is he?
Well, I think very intentionally, Priestley, and I'm sorry to be, if I sound correcty, but he very intentionally entitled the play An Inspector Calls. He's trying to sort of right away set you, to kind of place the inspector in a, not as the focal point. I think the inspector's role in the play is to try to draw everybody towards the truth about themselves and about their interactions with this young woman, Ava Smith. But it's definitely, he's there to draw attention to Ava. And I think, I think what Katie's done quite brilliantly is make the inspector kind of a conduit so that it draws all the attention towards the main focus, towards Ava Smith. He's, you know, Katie also, when it was early on, she gave us several incredible things to think about. One is that as an actor, when you say a line, you should be thinking about what your character really wants to say. When you say a line, even the most innocuous lines, of course, can have that kind of richness behind them. But the other thing she said, which really resonated with me, was that we should you think about the differences between yourself and the character you're playing. And I have to say that the main difference that instantly came to mind is that this guy, he speaks. He's able to talk. He's able to raise these issues, and he does it apparently fearlessly. And then I just love him for that, because I don't suppose I'm alone, but it's hard to make people face the truth sometimes.
So can you speak a few lines as the inspector? Give us a sense of his character.
Well, Katie, what do you think about, we don't want to give too many spoilers, but it's probably not, it's still, I think it's probably out in the world that not everything turns out great for all of these characters in this play. But there's some words he speaks at the ends that seem right. Katie, would that be okay to do a little bit of that, do you think?
Absolutely.
So, each of the characters has had a chance to kind of object to the fact that they've been drawn to this truth, and they're trying to grapple with the fact that they're going to have to carry this truth into the future. And the inspector says over and over again, remember what you did. Don't forget it. He's not telling them they were bad. He's not telling them what they're going to do next or what they have to do differently. He just wants them to remember. And right before this speech, one of the main characters, sort of a small industrialist, small-time industrialist, if there is such a thing, says, you know, I'd give thousands, honestly, thousands to do anything to change this young woman's life. And the inspector's response is swift. And you're offering the money at the wrong time, Mr. Burling. Ava Smith is gone. Can't do her any harm. Can't do her any good now either. Can't even say, I'm sorry, Ava Smith. But just remember this, all of you. There are millions and millions of Ava Smiths and John Smiths still with us, with their lives and their hopes and their fears, their suffering and their chance at happiness, all intertwined with our lives and what we think and say and do. We
We do not live alone upon this earth. We are responsible for each other. And if we will not learn that lesson, then the time is coming soon when we will be taught it in fire and blood and anguish.
Wow. So I am sorry, but we are about out of time. Just have a tiny bit of time left. Can you quickly tell us what we need to know if we want to watch this?
Well, if you want to watch it, the tickets are, aren't selling tickets at the door. So your tickets are available through the Jack and through our website. Proof of vaccination is required. So all attendees must provide that and as well wear masks. Those are just differences than our usual role. We open tonight, and all the performances are at McPheeters Hall. The evening performances are at 7:30, and the matinees are at 2 p.m.